Welcome to the podcast where heavy industrial industries meet the venture capital ecosystem, interviewing both thought-leading investors and pioneering founders to better understand the opportunities and challenges that lie ahead for digital industrial innovation. Your host is Ty Finley, and this is the Heavy Hitters Podcast.
Jason Pritzker joins us today from Chicago. Jason is the managing partner at 53 Stations, a venture capital firm supported by the Pritzker Organization, focused on investing in early stage tech-focused businesses across a range of industries in the U.S. He has various career roles spanning banking, hotels, metal bending, steel mill services, private equity, and now venture capital. And notable current VC investment highlights include Black Buffalo and PaintJet, and previously Hargray Communications, Omni Logistics, and Lithgow Contracting. Jason, it was great to have you down in Austin. I think it's only a couple of weeks back now, but basically get to continue our chat on the show. So thanks for joining and welcome to the Heavy Hitters.
Thanks for having me.
Awesome. Well, we always start the same place. I give a little short summary here, but obviously more color commentary on your journey going from banker to now launching 53 Stations. So tell us more how you got here.
Yeah. Thanks again for having me. So it's been a long and fun journey. I kind of always knew that the last stop on the train was going to involve investing with our family. And so I took kind of a circuitous route, started in hotels, actually, and then got into banking. I tried to start a business as an entrepreneur, and the business failed. And that was in Madrid, Spain. And I sent the banker who was helping me an email and said, hey, I'm kind of out of a job. What do you think I should do next? And he said, you should be an investment banker. And so that kind of took me to London for a little while, then moved to China back with Hyatt, helped open a hotel. And finally, I danced around the dance floor, finally threw my hat in after starting two software companies in 2010 and 2013. And I finally joined TPO, which is our family office. I'll do this kind of Quentin Tarantino style. I'll give you the longer answer. I'll go back to the beginning and then flash forward a little bit.
Go for it.
So the family story is a really good one. I want to spend a couple minutes talking about it because it really informs what we do at 53 Stations almost 100 years later. So our family came to the U.S. in the late 1800s from the Ukraine. My grandfather's grandfather came over. He was homeless, 7 years old, and was selling newspapers on the subway. He worked his way up through life. He became a pharmacist later in life and put his kids through school. While they were still homeless, they couldn't afford a roof over their head, but they got together once a week on Fridays. And the rule was you had to produce a nickel to give to somebody less fortunate than yourself, which is a little bit of a head scratcher when this kid was homeless, sleeping under a billboard. But we still keep that very close to us today. And whether it's 53 Stations or TPO, we really want to be great community members in whatever that means. That could be geographic, that can be industry related in the way we support our companies and our people. But that's a core part of what we do across all our business activity. So my grandfather then grew up in a household that had become kind of local business people, and they were buying three flats, fixing them up and selling them. And so he grew up in a mortgage math environment. And his core insight was, well, hey, how come I can't use mortgage math to buy a business, which hadn't really been done at the time? The answer was because debt capital was not available to people. You had to be a AAA rated public company in order to get a line of credit. And because of a bespoke reason, we had access to debt. His dad, I know I'm jumping around here, but his dad paid back somebody else's loan. He made an introduction to the First National Bank of Chicago, and the guy DQ'd on the loan, defaulted on the loan. My great-grandpa felt responsible because he was the one that made the introduction. And so he went to the bank and said, well, it's not my paper, but I'm going to pay back that other guy's loan. At a time when handshakes still mattered, the bank then said, when my grandpa came around, well, if these Pritzker guys are going to pay back somebody else's loan, they're probably going to pay back their own loan. Sure. So he had access to debt at a time when capital gains tax was over 75%.
Wow.
So what you had with this confluence of, on the one hand, this innovative business model where they were seeing, they were doing different math and seeing opportunities differently than the competition. And on the other hand, a tax environment that led to a view that it meant never made sense to sell anything. So over the next kind of 80 years, they bought and built businesses at a rapid pace. At the time of his death, there were about 200 companies in the portfolio. Hyatt is probably the most well-known. That started as a single property in LA in 1957. But we've been in about every kind of business you can think of. So then flash forward to today, TPO today, we kind of had a family food fight in the early 2000s. We decided it was better to break things up, create liquidity for a lot of shareholders. We took Hyatt public, but other than that, we sold everything. And so where TPO is today is a effectively a middle market private equity shop with no LPs. So the main focus there, 75% of time and capital, is direct control position investing with a much longer term mindset informed by that historical development of the portfolio. And 25% is earlier stage investing that fell into three categories, or minority investing, I should say, that fell into three categories: structured products, early stage investing, and co-invest. We did a review of business in 2019, and the early stage investing was lagging. I'd done private equity for about 10 years going into this period, and we decided that the early stage was lagging for two reasons. One was it was nobody's full-time job. There was no focus on it. And two, the private equity mentality is so different than the venture early stage mentality that when you put private equity investors around venture, you tend to get bad venture results. So we're either going to shut it down or run hard at it. And we became intrigued by the industrial logic of, it's kind of demonstrated over generations that we're really good at adding value and partnership at the mature scale of companies. If we could get really good at it at the early stage and create a feedback loop between those two sides of the house, that would be a pretty compelling value proposition and differentiate it in the market. And so I raised my hand and said I'd help to stand up the effort. And that's really how 53 Stations was born. What 53 Stations is today is a $190 million fund one focused on seed through Series B. And what we're really looking for are, first and foremost, compelling founders. What we've learned over a long period of time is that people win, great people win. And so if we can find a team that kind of checks a few boxes, our rubric is, if we think they can run a much, much bigger company than they're running today, we think they can outcompete their peers, if they're passionate about their business, and maybe most importantly, if they think about the development of their business in terms of long-term equity value compounding, that's what gets us excited. And that last one, let me just dig into that one a little bit. Today's private equity practice, kind of you're on a hamster wheel. You're selling your business every 5 years, or you're distributing excess cash or doing a dividend recap. Those are relatively tax inefficient results, and you lose the value of redeploying excess cash back into the business, either to support innovation, M&A, or better people in your business. So if we can find a team that loves what they do, wants to grow their business over a long period of time and really wants to find ways to double down on their business, that's what gets us excited. And at 53 stations, that is also true. And what we're really looking for kind of past those teams are early stage businesses that relate to our private equity portfolio. Mm-hmm. So on the private equity side of the house, we have 10 platforms, each of which has scale in their industries, and they're kind of in orthogonal industries. So we've got large assets in construction, wealth management, engineering services, industrial services focused on the steel sector, healthcare staffing, car washes, restaurants. And so if we can find a company that relates to one of those verticals, we get very excited.
Right on. Well, such rich history, to say the least. And, you know, maybe 53 stations is a newer brand, but the roots behind it, as you just laid out, the history of the Pritzker organization certainly is not new. And it really is. And we're going to tap into this more in the discussion. How do you leverage such a differentiated ecosystem and a network of operating businesses behind you guys to drive that value? I think it's seminal to where venture is headed, and you guys are in a great position to do that. Maybe if we could just go a little zoom in on more about those TPO assets that are aligned to this audience discussion, digital industrial, right? Defining construction, yep. Manufacturing, logistics, would be remiss, right? I think the website, 60 years of company building experience, 200 transactions, over $30 billion in equity value. What are those, call it more industrial aligned businesses that, of course, 53 Stations has a more generalist mandate, but really deep vertical expertise, like you mentioned, around construction. Maybe just to zoom in on more of some of what those businesses are. And
Yeah, happy to do that. So I think probably the ones that I would highlight are Lithgow Contracting, STV, Marmon Holdings, we'll get into in a minute. That's not one of ours today. But we still have very close relationship there. Let me just focus on and TMS International potentially. Mm-hmm. So Lithgow Contracting is the largest concrete contracting business in the U.S. If you go to ENR, it's number two. I'm more focused on profitability than volume. And so what Lithgow has done an incredible job of is professionalizing what has historically been a very locally oriented business. So we are building buildings. We don't build skyscrapers. We don't build stadiums. We don't do infrastructure work. We are building warehouses, data centers, big box retailers, hospitals, small hotels. Think that kind of category. And so, if you back out one major job that we're working on right now, mega project, the average job size is about $2 million, and we'll chin $2 billion of top line this year. And so we partnered with that team in 2015. It's been an incredible ride. When we partnered with them, the company was doing about $180 million of top line. And what they have, it was and continue to have, is an incredible set of repeatable processes and people that know how to execute on time and on budget. In a world where you're generally competing against a mom and pop, that scale gives us a real advantage. And I'll come back to Lithgow because I've been on the board of that company since we acquired it, and it's just an unbelievable story within this space. The second one I'd highlight is called STV. STV does a number of different engineering services. Think of them like a smaller version of AECOM or Jacobs. They're the little guy in the bulge bracket that has the capability and certifications to bid on big federal and state level projects. They specialize in bridges and tunnels, very water oriented, but also do airports and other big infrastructure oriented projects. That's, you know, 2,000 plus engineers sitting in rooms. They are not out on the job site, but one of the revenue lines is effectively being an owner's rep for the state or federal government while they're doing these big projects. Mm-hmm. So that's another really exciting one. And then TMS International is the largest service provider to the steel industry in terms of mill services in the U.S. And we've also got an international footprint. And so what that business is if you want to think about very high level, when you're making steel, you've got everything that happens before the furnace, you've got what happens in the furnace, and then everything that happens after the furnace. And a long time ago, the steel producers made the decision to focus in on what happens inside the furnace and effectively outsourced what happened outside the furnace. So on most of the mills in the U.S., we are managing the scrap yards. All of the yellow metal is ours. We're helping move materials around the site. And then after the furnace, we're disposing of the slag, the byproduct from the steelmaking process, and moving around semi-finished goods. We also have a brokerage business that's embedded in TMS that helps steel producers source their scrap more cost effectively. So those awesome. Three, I think, are the most core to what we're talking about here today.
Yeah, and I think this is such a good setup as we're going to start moving this conversation into the venture side of the equation, 53 stations. But that backdrop, again, of the platform and the network of those three specifically, amongst many other assets at TPO, that's a differentiated when founders think about how do we tap go to market and how do we tap value add. To have those three amongst other examples, big differentiated competitive advantage there, no question about it. And so maybe let's go that direction and move us forward here. How do you, as a firm, with that highly differentiated and pretty expansive commercial network, how do you use it to drive founder value to the founders you're engaging with, right? You said it earlier, you took on the baton to really move that early stage venture side forward. So I have no doubt you'll get tons of founders' attention being able to tap the likes of the Lithco Contracting, STV, and TMS, amongst others again. But how do you harness all of that potential, and I dare use the word, systemize it in a way of engaging that network at scale so that you deliver that value across 53 stations' diverse portfolio? Because having lived it a lot of myself in different roles, these are large organizations. They got a lot going on and many priorities for those VPs and others. So how do you get their attention when you reach out for collaboration for a portfolio company, identify the right champion, make sure that the budget's set up where they can meet milestones and set expectations and all the things that we don't want our founders to get into pilot purgatory? So I get off my soapbox. Jason, how do you guys systemize taking advantage of this big network for 53 stations?
Yeah, I would say that's a major focus for us right now. So 53 stations, we launched our first investment was in 22, middle of 22, but really in earnest, we launched this last year. So we are a very young fund, and we're still figuring out some of these systems.
So are the older funds, I can assure you. So
yeah, and so you know, I'd say a couple different things on that front. The way we're thinking about this progression is, we recognize that there is a lot of value to be extracted from our existing portfolio in service of getting into deals and then over-serving the founders of those deals. Phase two of this, I would say, and this is really important to answer your question, is going to be how do we make sure that we're not only extracting value from the mature companies, but adding value to them? And in that mm-hmm. regard, I think the founders of these early stage companies over time will have as much to contribute to those large scale companies as they'll be able to learn from those large scale companies.
That's right.
So we're kind of going one by each right now. We're not trying to bite them all off at the same time. I'm spending a lot of my time in construction and built world tech. But the short answer to your question is, we have to demonstrate to the large companies that it is valuable for them to spend time with us. And I think we're starting to see that. We're starting to do that. Let me pick on Lithco for a second.
Yeah, we were talking about that in Austin, how you're engaging the national Lithco entity. Yeah, let's go down that example. It was a great one.
Yeah, so here's what we're doing at Lithgow right now. What we've observed a couple of times, and I don't want to overgeneralize, but in construction tech, in construction in general, the go-to-market is really difficult. It's a highly fragmented market. It tends to be very locally oriented. And so in order to reach all those people, for an early stage company that's got to watch their cash burn, has scarce resources, needs to show quick progress, that can be a real challenge. And so what we're doing at Lithgow right now is we've just embarked on a project that will span, we have 25 different locations at Lithgow around the country. And the company is very decentralized. Part of our management philosophy is that we want to show up in any given market as the big local guy and make sure we have those local relationships. And so there's some pluses and minuses to that, that we live with. One of the minuses is that kind of the sales approach and where all the information lives, while we do have an ERP that's centralizing everything, a lot of that local knowledge is specific to the burg. And so what we're starting on right now is a project to go burg is a business unit running great. That mm-hmm. is Lithgow parlance, put in place by Rob Strobel, the CEO. We're going to go burg by burg, sit down with each team for a couple of days and really learn about their customers. And what we're hoping to achieve over the next 6 months of doing this is the ability to put together one document, a source of truth, if you will, that has an overlay around each one of their customers. Now, the trick, as you know, in construction is you got to keep your people busy. And so man planning to make sure that as soon as one project is done, you can move your people over to the next project is really important. The way you do that is by having a great mix, not only of product types, but also national GCs, regional GCs, and most importantly, the local GCs. Those guys might do a project every 5 years. They tend not to be as big. But if you don't have those in the pipeline and in your backlog, it's really hard to make sure you don't have gaps for your people. And so what we think we can do by going office by office is learning about that long tail of local GCs, aggregating the data into one place, and then over time doing qualitative overlay for each one of those people to understand what their interests might be. We think if we can put that document together and own it, that provides a ton of value to early stage companies that are struggling with a go-to-market within construction. So that's kind of one example of something that we're trying to do to tie together those more mature companies with the earlier stage ones.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that's where the future is tying together these amazing legacy businesses that are running our country with the innovation curve that in the venture world we're all trying to find. How can we connect and make better matches? And I would assume, Jason, after you've done all that homework with each of the, if I use the term right, the burgs at Lithgow, does that help? It has to. It helps inform, I'm guessing, when you go out to landscape a theme, whether it's fintech and construction or I think I saw you just keynoted for Matt Gray in the Built Worlds community, like where are the trends going? But from like we're actually talking to the operators daily. Does that help inform your hunting grounds and what you guys are looking to engage with in the venture side?
Absolutely. It has to. I mentioned Marmon Holdings earlier. Marmon was our industrial conglomerate in TPO1. We sold that company to Warren Buffett. But I worked there. That's the metal bending part of my career. They have a very specific management technique called 80-20 that informs everything they do. And a big component of 80-20 is customer-led innovation. Get out into your customer, into their environment, and ask them questions, and then work backwards from their needs to innovate your next great product, as opposed to engineers sitting in a room trying to come up with the next best thing. Just go ask your customers. And in a way, that's what we're trying to do here. is go let the customers tell us what their needs are, what their interests are, what they'd be willing to pay for, and then try and tie that to what we're seeing in the early stage market and kind of do some pattern matching around it to help us make better investment decisions on the way in and then be more helpful post-close. And I think that's a really important part of how we want to build 53 stations. I often say in PE, you're on the phone with your team three times a week, four times a week. You really become an extension of that portfolio company, and you're there to help in any way you can. We want to bring a little bit of that into venture and make sure that we're building this firm on the back of great founder NPS, because in effect, we're over-serving them in however we might be able to do that.
Yeah, and I think equally important here, when you've done that level of homework and you know what kind of high bar it's going to take to engage that incumbent with innovation, you have to get it right. A lot of times that first impression matters, because a lot of venture stuff gets thrown at them, you know, from folks that maybe aren't as focused on the sector. And for you to have curated for them directly what you've heard, and then this is the high bar, I've seen five, this is the one you should chat with. Not to say, you know, it's the one, but I just think that first impression, it then opens, it kind of cracks open the door. It opens the wedge to more external innovation within that company, or at least that's been my experience. But you got to get that first impression right in a lot of ways. So I'm excited as you do it with Lithgow and TMS and the other operating businesses, as you guys continue to move the platform forward. I mean, kind of, again, the ethos of digital industrials connecting these two worlds. I think you're right at the middle of it. So exciting. And maybe I want to ask a final question here, kind of aligned to a lot of this discussion. But launching a new venture fund associated to a longstanding legacy platform like TPO, let's talk about the role of established family office networks pushing ahead the early stage innovation agenda, as we were just discussing. Family offices, especially those where I've spent some of my career that have legacy roots in industrial markets, they are beginning to play a lot of a bigger role in the venture capital asset class as more and more begin to set up platforms to either direct invest or fund-to-fund invest in the venture asset allocation. And so, you know, case in point, I was in Fort Worth earlier this year at the annual Perot Family Hillwood Mobility Innovation Zone Conference, mouthful I know, but they have representatives from the Perots, the Cokes, the Crowns, et cetera, industrial supply chain family offices, all coming together to collaborate networks and resources to drive, again, that exact bridge we're talking about, legacy industry that is innovating in their own way, but also the innovation economy with venture as we think about it in our day job. So I know that's a setup. Three things I want to get an impression from you on. One, how do you think about this evolving trend of family offices direct investing in these sectors? You know, hot, cold, think it's actually happening. The second is there an ideal stage? I know you guys are seed to be somewhere in there. So is there a better stage for entering with all of that support behind you? And then the final one, how do we ultimately recruit more efforts aligned to this topic so we can bridge those real world operators and avoid the challenges of startups trying to approach maybe those incumbents that aren't as ready? So I know that's a lot, but I'd love to hear your thoughts on this evolution.
Yeah, so to answer just at a high level, I think it's very important, and I love seeing when family offices are leaning into direct investing and early stage. As I said, I'm kind of relatively new in the space, and so don't have a ton of data points around this. But what I'd say is, you know, venture is a tough business. We've talked about this offline. Venture is a tough business, and anything that you can do to help those companies out is really meaningful. And so where a family has a great platform and are willing to deliver that to early stage founders, that's really impactful. Mm-hmm. Second thing I'd say is, you know, venture capitalists, the traditional GP LP construct is also a really tough business and have their own set of needs, their own value drivers, and finding ways to productively engage with those investors who are really good at what they do and passionate about what they do, finding ways to do that I think is an also an important next step for the kind of family offices. What I saw evolve in private equity was you used to have, you were either a strategic acquirer or you were a financial acquirer, a PE shop. And family offices kind of, the companies didn't know how to deal with them. The bankers didn't know how to deal with them. They didn't know which one of those buckets that you fell into. And it took a lot of time for many families to kind of get the message out that they have the sophistication, the speed, the capabilities of a financial acquirer, but maybe more the timeline of a strategic acquirer. And I think I'm starting to see that same evolution in venture, where what we all need to do is kind of pull together and tell this consistent message into the market around the capabilities and sophistications of family offices in the investing space. Because there is really, there's a lot of advantages to partnering with a sophisticated family office. And so we kind of just need to keep getting that message out there. I'm new enough. I haven't been on the conference scene enough. So I haven't been to many family office conferences in the venture space, but I'm excited to get to know the other families who are participating in this.
Absolutely. And, you know, maybe to the point of recruiting and activating, waving the flag around the whole discussion, you mentioned at some point, though, it was just you decided to take on the baton. How does that flywheel get started in other groups, et cetera? And again, it's regardless of family office or standing up a fund like you guys did that has that as a resource and a backbone. How do we find more of the Jason Pritzkers and activate that?
Or I'm not sure you want to find more Jason Pritzkers.
Unfair question, but you know, that's the whole purpose of the podcast here, building an ecosystem, sharing lessons learned. So I don't know if you have.
If I'm being honest, I raised my hand to do this because I was probably the most expendable person in TPO. The rest of the TPO investors are really accomplished private equity investors. My track record's not bad either, but these are investors who are getting recruited by Blackstone and GTCR, and without any hubris, I will say we're really good at what we do. And so I was more expendable, so I put my hand up to do this. We in the better lucky than good category, we took 2021 to learn about venture. And didn't make any big bets. We seeded a couple of funds, we anchored a couple of funds to and then we were on the phone with them constantly to learn. So I'd say the first really important thing is to learn before you act and take the time to understand the rhythms of the industry, the value drivers, and how you can be a good partner, not only to companies, but to other investors, because it is a much more collaborative industry than private equity. One of the things that we learned along the way is that, for better or worse, there seemed to be some negative signal around going into the market as a family office. That I referred to that earlier in my last statement on the PE side of things. We observed some of that. And so you hit on something really important, which is talent. We made the decision that in order to attract the best investing talent, we have some great people on our team. Kevin King is my partner. He joined from General Catalyst. Kelly Goldstein, another partner, head of platform, came out of Harlem Capital. In order to attract the best investors and the best founders, we felt it was important to have independent branding and to go to market as a fund. The mm-hmm. fund dynamics are distinct enough that if you don't have to return capital to LPs, as an example, or you're not working on the same timeline as potential co-investors, you may end up being misaligned. Similarly, with the founders, much easier for them to understand that you are a fund than some of the squishiness of being a family office. And maybe most importantly, we need to emphasize that the success or failure is quantified in the specific company. In other words, there isn't another motivation. We're not making these investments just because they're good for the mature scale company. We right. are all in on making sure that those early stage companies are successful on their own.
Well, great advice and great way you guys have structured the 53 stations in the brand. And, you know, your humility is not accepted about Dispendable, because there's not many of you that have lived a tech startup operator yourself. You can empathize, you know what they're going through, and be able to the next day jump into the boardroom of a Lithgow or someone of that ilk. So we need more of you, Jason. That's my sob story back to you, but we'll keep waving the flag here.
We need
here.
More of you, Ty. You're right. Awesome. I've really enjoyed getting to know you and engaging on various topics. It's been a pleasure.
Well, the ecosystem is coming to life, which is great. So I'll push us forward here. Final question. We always love to bring it back to those most important people in this whole equation, the founders. And so as they maybe hear the podcast or more broadly find out about 53 stations, words of wisdom for those founders when they reach out, maybe like a key to success as they enter the conversation with you, or a common challenge to make sure they head off before they start getting to know you guys.
Great question. I guess I'm going to give a little bit of a soft answer to this one, which is that, you know, at TPO and at 53 stations for a very long time, what we have seen as our core competency is being great partners to passionate people in helping them achieve their version of success. And it's that last part I want to highlight. Our job as capital partners and investors is to get on your train. It's not to create our own tracks. And so being really clear about what your version of success is, because if you make great progress, you're going to be faced with high-class problems. Do I hire more people? Do I spend capital on other forms of innovation? Should I sell the company to a strategic? Am I holding on for an IPO? And really having a crystal clear view of what your version of success is, so that we can then work backwards to understand how we might be helpful in that regard, is very important and impactful for us.
Excellent. Well, they know what they're jumping into when they start to meet you guys. Let's do this. We always wrap up. It's a little quick hitter section, a little bit of fun at the end of the podcast here. So if you're ready for some rapid fire Q&A, we'll jump in.
Let's go for it.
All right. What's the number one thing you're looking for when you do meet one of those founders? I know we walked through a little bit of that color, but specific to that founder, what are you looking for?
We're looking for passion and grit when we're talking to founders. People that solve their own problems and really have the conviction to go the distance is something that we're inspired by.
Not an easy task. It's a great one. Maybe what's one resource, could be book, podcast, blog, whatever you'd recommend to the audience to follow in this ecosystem or more broadly?
Yeah, so there's a book I'm kind of obsessed with right now that I would highlight. It's called Outcomes Over Outputs. It's by Joshua Seiden. We've implemented a new management. I didn't really talk about Hyatt Hotels, but we've implemented a new management technique there, which is outcomes-based leadership. And it's a really phenomenal way of thinking about things. We're now trying to figure out how to implement it at 53 stations. And it's a quick read, and I think it could be very impactful to a lot of founders out there.
Excellent. Who's the author again?
Joshua Seiden, Seiden.
Okay. Hadn't heard of that one. I'll check it out. One person who may be a good guest on the show to help us, again, build ecosystem and keep waving the flag.
Rob Strobel from Lithco Contracting.
I like that answer a lot.
He's a mature scale guy, but he's an incredible. He's built an unbelievable, repeatable process and culture at Lithco that I think could be inspiring to a lot of people.
Definitely love bringing the built world operators on here. Great one. And then finally, Jason, best way for folks to reach out to you after the show or 53 stations?
Jason at 53 stations. You can find me on LinkedIn. Anyone at 53 stations you reach out to, and we're getting better and better at sharing all the information that comes in. So should be pretty easy to find us.
Right on. Well, we've got a lot more ecosystem building ahead of us and connecting these mission critical legacy businesses, however we define it, in this industrial swim lane that we're talking about today with the venture ecosystem. I think our job to play the bridge between is we've got an exciting decade ahead of us, Jason. So look forward to it.
Me too. Thank you so much for having me, Todd.